This is the takeaway for Friday, September the 15th, 2017.
Hey, do you know about the USA? Do you know about the government? Can you tell me about the Constitution? Hey, learn about the USA.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're so happy to have you with us on this Friday. And Sunday is Constitution Day here in America. 230 years ago, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and our founding fathers met after a long, hot summer in Philadelphia and ratified that U.S. Constitution. Now, the original Constitution, it permitted slavery. It excluded women. It was never perfect. But it did form the basis of the American argument. Strict interpretation or negotiable guidepost, a rough collection of individuals, or a growing American family that agrees to play by the same rules. Constitution Day is a chance to think about all of that. Or, if you're Lewis Michael Seidman, to talk about scrapping the Constitution altogether. Lewis Michael Seidman is a constitutional law professor at Georgetown Law, and even though he loves teaching his students about it, Seidman says that 230 years is a long enough life for a living document, and that it's time for this country to leave the Constitution behind.
This is our country. We live here. We have a right to have the kind of country we want, and that means it would be wrong for France to rule us or for the United Nations Security Council to rule us. Thomas Jefferson famously said that the past is like another country. And it's also wrong for people who've been dead for several hundred years to rule us. We should decide for ourselves what kind of country we want to live in. Beyond that, I think the Constitution has really a detrimental effect on political debate in this country. It does two really bad things. One is it distracts our attention from the issues that we actually ought to be talking about and instead causes us to talk about irrelevant legal questions about like what certain words meant 200 years ago. Perhaps worse, it raises the temperature. Because instead of just talking about a good faith disagreement between two people, we end up accusing each other of not being real Americans because we're not willing to be faithful to this document that's supposed to define us as Americans.
Give me an example of a debate or a fight where you think those bad things are happening because of the Constitution.
Sure. I think a pretty good example is the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. What we ought to be talking about are things like whether gun control really works, whether it would reduce the level of violence, whether it's practical, whether it's sensible to think that among the fundamental rights people ought to have are rights to carry firearms. But as soon as the Constitution's introduced into it, then, you know, suppose I say, well, you know what, I think gun control is a pretty good idea. And you say, but it's unconstitutional. Well, then, what am I supposed to say? Either I have to say, well, the Constitution doesn't really matter, which in our culture you're not allowed to say, or then I have to get into a constitutional argument with you about, you know, whether the framers of the Second Amendment meant to incorporate the English Bill of Rights into the provision, you know, things that are just really, really profoundly beside the point. And the other thing that happens is now we all of a sudden get really angry at each other because, you know, we can talk about the statistics about the level of violence in states that do and don't control guns and nobody's accusing anybody of anything. But if you say, you know what, your views are just off the table because our founding document prohibits them, I'm not going to take that sitting down. Now you're talking about something that's going to make me angry. And the last thing we need in the country right now is more people not being civil to each other and not talking in good faith about what they actually disagree about.
Well, let's take a real world example then that's relevant to the political moment. How about the First Amendment that has a protection of freedom of the press? Congress shall make no law restricting the freedom of the press. I'm paraphrasing. We are at a point in American politics where the chief executive not only attacks the press in public, calls them the enemy of the people, has floated trial balloons of legally reining in the press, and with the American media as unpopular as it is with large swaths of the voting population, you could see a time in the next couple of years where the chief executive could succeed in passing laws making certain press activities illegal. But we have a rule that says you can't do that even if people would like it.
So I'm a big fan of freedom of the press. I think the press serves an important function, and I would be horrified if there were laws that restricted freedom of the press. But there are several points that ought to be made here. First of all, nothing that Trump has done so far violates the Constitution. So what we're talking about might be something that he would do in the future. And yes, he might do those things, but that leads to two other points. If before he does those things, he appoints enough justices to the Supreme Court, it's perfectly possible to read the Free Press Clause in ways that might well, by their lights, justify the things he's doing. So in the end, again, it's not a piece of paper. It's the people who are doing one thing or another. But then there's also, Todd, there really is a more fundamental point. So I'm in favor of freedom of the press, but it does not seem to me to be a good argument for somebody who thinks there ought to be less press freedom to just say, well, tough luck. This is what people thought 200 years ago. And by the way, people who are not only all dead, but who had no idea about things like television and the internet, and nothing about the way the press operates in our modern world, or for that matter, about concentrations of power in organizations like, say, Fox News. And so I think it's wrong just to try to shut down an argument about even something as important as freedom of the press by the essentially authoritarian move of saying, sorry, we're not allowed to talk about that because of some decision that was made 200 years ago.
What about the broader rules of the game here, Mike Seidman? There are parts of the Constitution that guarantee that all of these debates can take place and hopefully not result in wars. We have separation of powers. We have judicial review that are all part of the Constitution and sort of float above our politics and provide pressure valves so that we can argue and fight, so that we have branches of government that check each other and that none gets too powerful. And these are designed to allow the very arguments that you're talking about and allow the Republic to keep chugging along. What do you think about that?
So, Todd, you're making very good points, and it's appropriate for you to press me on these issues. Here's my response. First of all, it's not like we would be starting all over again. So this is the United States in 2017, where we have been doing things the same way for a very long time. And even if there were not a constitution, the force of inertia, of tradition, and of the very desire not to have the chaos that would be produced if things changed in a big way very quickly, all of that is plenty forceful enough.
So let's talk about some of the limitations of Article 2, in your view, Mike Seidman.
Okay.
You have written a lot about abuses of executive power by presidents, but you say that some of those abuses have been America at its best. What did you mean?
So there is a kind of mainstream story that says that if you look at the traditions of our country, the traditions have been traditions of constitutional obedience, and that those have been the high points of our country's history. I think there's actually a pretty powerful counter-narrative that the moments in our history, or some of the moments in our history that we ought to be most proud of, are cases where political leaders have transcended the limits of the Constitution and done things that turn out to have been right, even though they were unconstitutional.
All right, give me some examples.
So maybe the main example is Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. That was a just remarkably audacious act that destroyed more private property in one fell swoop than at any time other than the communist revolution in Russia and the seizing of church lands associated with the French Revolution. It destroyed property that was like a quarter of the total wealth in the United States. And importantly, Abraham Lincoln himself was on record saying that doing that was unconstitutional. But in 1862, he decided, I think, in contravention of his own views about the Constitution and most of the views of most other people, that in the end it was more important that this huge war with tremendous loss of life ought to be fought for human freedom and not just for arid constitutional provisions. And so he changed the nature of the war and made it about abolishing slavery. And that was a great act on his part. It's an act that we do and ought to celebrate. And importantly, it was an act of constitutional resistance, not constitutional obedience.
Well, Professor Mike Seidman, I acknowledge that I feel the need for a sweet chaser before we let you go here. Do me a favor, say something nice. What's your favorite amendment?
I don't have a favorite amendment. I think the ambition of the 14th Amendment, protecting the privileges and immunities of American citizens, equal protection and due process, those are things I can really, they move me. But the point is, those are also very vague aspirations, and they have to be filled in ways that promote justice and fight injustice. And the constitutional text alone doesn't do that.
Lewis Michael Seidman says, Happy Constitution Day, and he says it by saying, maybe we should get rid of it. He's got a better way. Professor Mike Seidman of Georgetown Law, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Todd. It was a lot of fun.
Well, if getting rid of the Constitution is too big of a leap for you, like it is for me, how would you change it? There are 27 amendments in the Constitution. The 27th was added in 1992. So here's the question. What should be the 28th?
This is Donna from Winter Park, Florida.
This is Andrew in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
I'm Victoria of Dallas, Texas.
This is David in North Miami Beach, Florida.
I think it's time to eliminate the Electoral College.
Overturning Citizens United is the most important amendment I can think of.
I think the 28th Amendment should be the ERA. It's about time women were formally recognized as full and equal members of our society.
Everyone gets a basic income equivalent to 10% of a congressperson's salary.
If I could add a 28th Amendment, it would include for all Americans a public health insurance that covers treatment and medication and public college, including books and tuition.
A lot of you wrote to us with your ideas for a 28th Amendment on Twitter. From Jack Jackson, the number of seats in the House of Representatives shall expand by one for every 50,000 citizens. And from at PAMCG, we got this, sweeping electoral reform, including the universal right to vote, abolish the Electoral College, votes for territories and for D.C., and campaign finance law. What would your 28th Amendment be to the Constitution? Call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet it at The Takeaway.
Build that wall.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And that was candidate Donald Trump chanting his famous campaign promise at a rally back in May of 2016. Now, a lot of campaign promises can fall by the wayside. I mean, that's politics. But now it seems that a potential immigration deal the president has made with congressional Democrats does not include the wall that he promised. Instead, the deal may protect DACA recipients, those young immigrants who came here illegally with their parents, in exchange for border security funding, but no mention of funding for the wall at all. That gets delayed till later. Well, now news of this deal has rattled all over American politics and shaken the president's conservative base to its core.
At these rallies during the 2015-2016, I don't remember hearing, repair the fence, repair the fence. If this goes down the way I fear it will go down, mark my words, this will be an electoral nightmare for Republicans.
The backlash to this deal from Trump supporters was swift, it was strong, and it was angry. And the reason why? Immigration is the one issue they care most about. That's according to Joe Walsh, the former conservative congressman from Illinois and host of the radio show The Joe Walsh Program. Joe says if this deal becomes a reality, it will be a huge betrayal to Trump's core base.
Todd, he didn't run on, I'll build the wall later. He didn't run on, we'll fund it later. This is the third opportunity since Trump's been elected that he could have secured funding for the wall. And it's the third time that he's said, no, we're not going to do it. We'll do it later. I know there are a lot of Trump supporters out there who believe the guy still walks on water, but every time he does this, Todd, more and more of his supporters get disappointed. The physical wall matters.
Right. So, Joe, you say there are millions of Trump supporters who aren't going to leave him no matter what. And that just makes me want to ask you, I mean, isn't this largely what people signed up for, getting things done? I mean, people knew Donald Trump was unpredictable, that he was basically non-ideological and a deal maker. And that's what you've got here, an unpredictable, fairly non-ideological deal, right?
Well, Todd, you've got sort of two kinds of Trump supporters. And every Trump supporter sort of wanted to blow the place up, drain the swamp, tear it down, all of that crap. But you've got one type of Trump supporter, like a Sean Hannity and all the people out there, again, who believe this guy can do no wrong. He'll get away with this with them. But then you have the other Trump supporter that believes in the issues and they want the wall built. They want illegals out of this country. They want dangerous Muslims kept out of the country. You've got a lot of Trump supporters who don't want him to cut deals with Nancy Pelosi that might actually make things worse. It's just like every time he does this, Todd, his support is nicked. And it's not like he's grabbing a lot of Democrats' support, so this will hurt him.
Right. So how much of this, Joe, matters to your listeners, those parts of the deal that you talked about, the wall, getting illegal immigrants out, and Muslims, as you mentioned, I think you called them dangerous Muslims. How much of this is just the fact that the words Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer appear in front of the words deal with Donald Trump? Just that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Todd. I don't think Pelosi and Schumer matter. Look, my typical listener, the typical conservative Trump supporter out there, doesn't give a damn that it's Schumer and Pelosi. I do, because I was there, I worked there. As far as they're concerned, they're all swamp creatures. The average Joe Walsh listener, Todd, is more fed up with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. That's why they're actually cutting Trump's slack. Because, and again, there's some truth to this. Trump has given the Republicans 8 months to pull their head out. They haven't gotten anything done. Oh, my God, he's got no choice but to work with Pelosi and Schumer.
And Joe, how much of this is about the promise of the physical wall versus people's feelings about undocumented immigrants and wanting them out of the country, even though DACA allows young people who were brought here by their parents, allows them to stay? How much of it is about that?
Donald Trump got elected because the American people who voted for him are fed up that people are in this country illegally. Look, I served in Congress. I know there's a lot you can do on the border with technology and even manpower. But the average Trump voter voted for a physical wall.
But Joe, a lot of people who followed politics for their whole career, and look, I know everyone was wrong about Trump getting elected, and so was I. I was wrong about it too. But every time he made that promise, we're going to build a wall, Mexico's going to pay for it, it just got 10 feet higher. People who understood where the money was and where the votes were, even though Trump was doing well, thought, he's probably not going to get this done. He's probably not going to get Republicans to go along with it. And Mexico's definitely not going to pay for it. There are a lot of people who knew this was going to be really hard.
Well, I think a lot of people in your profession, in my current profession, and in the media certainly believe that when Trump said that, that was a throwaway line that didn't matter. But you got to break that throwaway line up, Todd. Mexico's going to pay for it. I think even the average Trump supporter understood that wasn't going to happen. If Donald Trump had not said, I'm going to build a wall, he would not be president. I firmly believe that. And if Donald Trump, sometime between now and the next 2.5-3 years, does not in a big way begin construction on a physical wall, Todd, I don't think he'll get reelected.
And if there are more Pelosi, Schumer, Trump deals to come?
Look, the deal they cut a couple weeks ago, extend the debt ceiling, fund the government, and pay for the hurricane. I mean, that was a deal that I was screaming against, but the average Trump supporter was okay with it. But that wasn't why Trump got elected.
So, Joe Walsh, if you had the chance today, next week, on Tuesday, to vote for Donald Trump again, would you do it?
Yes, but ask me that question when you and I fully know what this deal looks like.
Joe Walsh is a former congressman. He's the host of the Joe Walsh Program. Joe, it's good to have you back.
Always love it, Todd. Thanks.
Welcome back. It's The Takeaway, and you're hearing there the sounds of Saturn, transmitted roughly 930 million miles to Earth by the spacecraft Cassini. Cassini was launched almost 20 years ago, tasked with exploring Saturn, its distinctive rings, and its 53 moons. But all good things must come to an end, and today Cassini ended its 13-year journey around Saturn's system with a grand finale, a long-planned plunge to the gas giant's surface. Cassini sent its last image on Thursday and then burned up in the atmosphere in the early hours of the morning. Emily Rice is an astronomer and professor of astrophysics at the CUNY College of Staten Island and a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. And I asked her why they had to kill Cassini.
They didn't have to kill it, technically. One of the thoughts for the end of this Cassini mission was actually to put Cassini in a stable orbit, a very long-term stable orbit around Saturn, and just kind of let it die natural causes. But the Saturn system is special partially because of what Cassini discovered. There's so many moons that have what we now understand to be prebiotic conditions that even if there's a tiny, tiny, tiny chance that these might be habitable worlds or potentially inhabited by microbial life, we don't want to take any chances with interfering with that life elsewhere in the solar system. And so that's one of the reasons why we want to make sure that Cassini burns up and there's no even minute chance of interfering with some of these potentially habitable places in the solar system.
Oh, so that's sterile disposal. I didn't know that. That's really interesting. Give us a Cassini eye tour of the Saturnian system. What did we learn from Cassini?
Oh, my goodness, so much. I think it's so easy to take for granted everything we've learned because Cassini has now been in orbit around Saturn for more than 10 years. Basically, every picture that you can think of Saturn, like anything that comes to mind, is from Cassini. We've learned so much about its ring system and its moons, its atmosphere, the big moon Titan and Titan's atmosphere and Titan's surface. We've learned how some of the moons actually kind of refuel the rings by spouting off material from their surfaces and possibly below their surfaces. It's amazing the amount of detail that we've gotten from the Cassini mission.
And we got these incredible sort of yellow-hued photos from the surface of Titan thanks to the Huygens probe that left Cassini and landed on the surface.
Yeah, it's such a huge deal. It's, you know, and now we almost even take it for granted. Like I said, the pictures around Cassini and even Huygens, it was the first lander in the outer solar system, the first lander on a moon other than Earth's moon. It's this huge moon around Saturn that has this huge, thick atmosphere. It's so unique in the solar system that it's just unbelievable that we were able to put a spacecraft onto the surface, even if it was just for a few seconds that it survived. But the couple minutes of going down through the atmosphere is just a wealth of data.
Well, Cassini is gone. Emily Rice, I'm personally very sorry to see it go. But the question with this kind of exploration always is what's next? So whether it's interplanetary inside the solar system or interstellar for you, what is next?
I think the next exciting thing that everybody's going to want to watch out for is the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. It survived Harvey thanks to a lot of astrophysicists and technicians that were working overnight in Houston, where it's currently being tested, and it's scheduled for launch in October of 2018. So coming up really soon, just a little bit over a year, and this is going to be a super exciting space telescope to look not only at the solar system and hopefully exoplanets around nearby stars, but also into the very, very, very distant universe and look at kind of what we now call the dark ages at the beginning of the universe. And partially it's called the dark ages because we haven't been able to see anything that far away yet.
A new mission begins as another one ends, but today we're bidding farewell to Cassini, which has crashed through the surface, the gaseous surface of Saturn. Emily Rice, astronomer, professor of astrophysics at the CUNY College of Staten Island. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
Don't be there, I want to see it.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed.com, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com.
And we go to St. Louis now and the outcome of a closely watched murder trial. It's the case of then police officer Jason Stockley, who shot 24-year-old Anthony Lamar Smith to death after a car chase. Today, a judge in St. Louis ruled that Stockley is not guilty of first-degree murder in that 2011 shooting. Attorneys at the time of the death had decided not to charge Stockley, but an internal affairs investigation uncovered new evidence in 2016, and he was charged with first-degree murder. The verdict has sparked protests in St. Louis, many of them expected. Shula Newman is executive editor at St. Louis Public Radio, and she's with me now. Thanks for being here, Shula.
Hi, Todd. Good to be here.
Well, there were a lot of concerns around security leading up to today. How is St. Louis reacting to the verdict?
Well, predictably, there's several hundred people who are protesting throughout downtown, and we also have reports of other parts of the city, some protesters breaking out, blocking streets. They attempted to block one of the major highways here. So it's, you know, not unexpected, but so far, no violence or any other kind of, aside from just disruption of people walking in the streets.
The protest,
nothing bad.
So the protest peaceful so far. Remind us of some of the basic facts of this case, though. One factor that loomed over this case, and there were many, is that is Jason Stockley telling his partner during the chase that preceded the shooting that he was going to kill Anthony Smith?
Right. And this was recorded during the chase, and in the court decision, in the judge's decision, he said that during the chase, there was a lot of different recordings, different police channels were open. And when this came out of Stockley's mouth, it was in the heat of pursuit. Stockley himself claims that he doesn't remember making that statement. And the judge in his decision also said people say really horrible things when they're under a lot of stress. So that was basically disregarded as a way for him to be charged with first-degree murder.
Stockley claimed self-defense. He claimed that he had a reasonable fear that his life was in danger because Anthony Lamar Smith had gone for a gun. And as a countercharge, Stockley was charged by prosecutors with having planted a gun on Lamar Smith.
Right. And again, the judge did not find evidence of this. The gun that they claimed was planted, that was found in the car, was too big for Stockley to have hidden, the judge claims, that there was no evidence from all the video cameras that had actually recorded this, that he was wearing anything bulky that he could have hidden the gun in. So the judge says there's no evidence that he actually had the gun and had the opportunity to hide it because that would have been captured on the video footage.
So Jason Stockley was acquitted by a judge. He had waived his right to a jury trial here. That's why the judge rendered this verdict. What is the community saying? I mean, what was at stake in terms of relations and the community in St. Louis with this trial?
Well, a lot. I mean, we're still healing from the Michael Brown shooting 4 years ago and several other police-involved shootings since then. It's been interesting. Most public officials have come out with statements, calling for peaceful protests, of course, but several public officials, including Kim Gardner, who was the circuit attorney, the prosecuting attorney, disagrees with the decision, but says the judge's word is the judge's word. She said that what needs to happen now is we need to really reform how we investigate police-involved shooting and how we change the system, essentially. There's a lot of disappointment by public officials in this case and in the ruling.
And Jason Stockley, where is he now?
Well, I assume he is in his home, or he'll soon be returning to his home in Texas, in Houston, where he now lives.
And is no longer a police officer in St. Louis?
Correct. He's not. He hasn't been for a while.
A verdict in St. Louis, much anticipated from the 2011 shooting of Anthony Lamar Smith by Officer Jason Stockley, a judge today ruling that Jason Stockley not guilty of first-degree murder charges, and now St. Louis is reacting. Shula Newman, executive editor at St. Louis Public Radio, thanks for bringing us up to date.
You're welcome.
Less than a week after Hurricane Irma roared through the Caribbean and Florida, the scope of the destruction in the aftermath is still coming to light. So far, the death toll stands at 69, with at least 38 dead across the Caribbean and 31 in the United States. The Florida Keys bore the brunt of the storm as it made landfall in the United States. Recovery is now underway, but it's a daunting job. The highway from the mainland is now open for the first time since the storm, so supplies are beginning to flow, but communications have been scant, and few people have seen the full extent of the damage firsthand. But Nancy Klinginger has. Nancy is a reporter with WLRN in Miami and a resident of the Florida Keys, and she told us how her experience riding out the storm affected her and the people around her.
The storm itself was scary in some ways, although not quite as scary as I might have expected for being that close to the center of a Category 4 hurricane. The building I was in is very solid, concrete, on high ground. We could hear the wind, but you couldn't really feel it besides the occasional gusts. And the water didn't come up to where we were. So it was not as scary as you might have expected, but it was scary enough.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. And it makes me want to ask you about the moment, once the storm passed, that you opened the door and walked outside.
We walked out. We saw, you know, some big trees had gone over. A few pieces of roofing tile had been peeled off here and there. But we also saw that the town looked basically intact.
And is that the case during your travels around the Keys with your reporting? What kind of conditions have you seen?
I did go up to Big Pine Key yesterday, and that is sort of ground zero. It was, you know, just to the east of the eye wall. And they did suffer some pretty good damage. They'll be out of power, I imagine, for some time in most of it, in most of the island. Amazingly enough, most of the structures, like homes and businesses, look intact, at least from the outside. I only saw a few sort of blown apart or blown over structures. But the people there are, you know, they're in a disaster zone. They're dealing with food and water and getting generators to get some electricity and start working on fixing their places up again or just surviving for now.
I know, Nancy, that you've been going down to the local Winn-Dixie supermarket in order to get internet, because I think that was the only place in your neighborhood that had it.
I was actually on Big Pine Key yesterday. The Winn-Dixie store there is an amazing story. The store manager was in the store during the storm, and one of the employees had his trailer, his home, blow apart around him during the storm, you know, thought he may well die, and somehow made his way in water to the store. The manager heard him and let him in, and he survived there. They've got the place up and running. It's well stocked with groceries. It's got AC. And that guy who made his way to the store was there working. It's just amazing. And a lot of people in the community were there, and they have Wi-Fi. It's incredible.
And so it's become this sort of community meeting place, because it's the place with the supplies and the place you can send an email.
Right. Exactly.
Nancy, you've been reporting on Twitter as well about people that you've been coming across as you travel around the Keys, or at least in your one trip up to Big Pine Key. You talked about Stacy Young and Cherie Pruitt.
Yeah. We were on our way up the Keys yesterday, and on Big Coppet Key, which is about 10 miles from Key West, we saw these two women just walking up the road carrying luggage, you know, dragging roller cases. And we thought, huh, that's weird. So we pulled over and said, where are you going? And they basically said, we're going to the mainland. And we said, you're walking? And they said, yeah, we can't take it in Key West anymore. It's too hot. There's no water. They just wanted out. They had somehow made contact with Young's mother, and she was going to meet them there, and they were on their way out. They had already gotten one ride, and we gave them another one as far as Big Pine Key, and I'm praying that they got more rides along the way.
Nancy, what's the state of policing and presence of authorities around the Keys? At times like this, looting is always a concern. Nobody likes to think it could be part of their community, but it's always a potential part of disaster recovery. And the roads have to stay clear so that all these supply trucks can get in.
Yeah, there's been a lot of rumors, but I would not really want to give those a huge amount of credence. I haven't heard confirmed reports of looting. People are on alert, and there is a very, very heavy police presence. Both our local police, the Monroe County Sheriff's deputies, and I've seen Homestead Police and other and police from other municipalities around town. We now have a couple of National Guard units in the islands, both on Big Pine and in Key West, and probably further up the Keys than I've seen. And they are giving out food and water, and I think just generally maintaining security.
So what does the next week look like, do you think, Nancy, as you look around the situation and see people recovering? What's ahead of the community there?
Well, I think the immediate need is to get our water line up and functioning and get our communications back online, because when we can have regular water service and make sure that 911 is operating, then they, I'm sure, will feel much safer about letting people back in. And then it's a matter of clearing up, cleaning up. People who have suffered real losses will need to file with insurance companies and FEMA, make sure they have a secure, safe place to live if they are going to need to rebuild, and generally try to get the economy back and running where we can in places that are relatively intact, like Key West.
You know, you talked to me last week about that island spirit, the thing that drives people to live in the Florida Keys because they don't want mainland life. And I wonder how that's feeling now and how that's surrounding people.
It's definitely come into play. People here are pooling resources, helping each other out. Total strangers help each other out. The morning, or it was probably the early afternoon on Sunday, after we had first gotten into our house, there was a big royal poinciana tree that had come down sort of in front of our house, and it was blocking the road. And some guy just pulled up in a Chevy Suburban with a chainsaw and started sawing it up into pieces that you could roll out of the way. So people are doing what they can for whom they can. Anything that people have, they're making sure that others are taken care of as well.
Well, Nancy Klingener, it's very good to talk to you again, not only to get your update, but to know that you and your family are doing just fine. And your eyes and ears and your reporting on the ground are an enormous asset to us. So thank you, and thank you for calling in.
You're welcome, Todd.
Nancy Klingener is a reporter with WLRN in Miami, in the Florida Keys, and a Keys resident.
The Takeaway is supported by Roadside Attractions, presenting Stronger, starring Jake Gyllenhaal as Jeff Bowman, whose strength became a symbol of hope after a national tragedy, in theaters September 22nd. And LegalZoom.com, providing American business owners with legal advice through its network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. An epic retelling of history comes to American TVs this weekend. Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's 18-hour documentary series, The Vietnam War, premieres this Sunday on PBS. The series tries to get away from the strict American perspective that many of us know in documentaries like this. It includes the stories and firsthand accounts of North and South Vietnamese whose lives were torn apart by the war.
You know, you have Vietnamese Americans, and particularly of the older generation, who have not really had a forum to talk about their trauma. And so just what I think has happened is you re-victimize. You feel victimized. You feel a sense of loss, and you have to blame somebody.
That's Tan Tan, host of Second Wave. It's a podcast produced by KUOW in Seattle and PRX, all about the Vietnamese-American refugee experience. The Burns-Novick documentary caught Tan's attention because her family lived it. By 1990, more than 500,000 Vietnamese had left their homes and emigrated to the United States. Tan Tan's family was among them, but once they arrived, in her family, no one talked about the war.
The war ended in 1975, and you know, every Vietnamese family has a different story. My family's story is that my mom and dad escaped by boat before I was born, arrived here in the United States in the late 1970s. And I think the war was just too fresh in their minds. I think they didn't want to burden us, their children, with that pain. And so I think it stopped a lot of them from talking about the war. Now, my mom and dad are very different from one another. My mother, her family was in the countryside. You know, they both come from the same village, Trang Bang, which is where Napalm Girl, that photograph, was taken. And so they saw so much bombing. They lost family members, and so they experienced it firsthand. But my mother's way of dealing with it is to not really talk about it. You know, coming here to the United States, there was no time to dwell on the past. She needed to work, and she needed to move on. And also, she's ready to live a safe and you know, comfortable life here in the United States. My father is a little different in that he feels that during the war, he was not fully aware of what was going on. Information was not free-flowing, you know, in South Vietnam. And I think since coming to the United States as a refugee, he has kind of been the opposite, where it's not that he dwells, but he's very curious. He reads up on history. He listens to radio programs. He has tried to spend the last 40-some years just trying to reconcile for himself, just asking himself what happened and why did our side lose. But my parents are still very, I think they get concerned, like, are you sure you want to know this? You know, why are you so curious? And the older I get, you know, the more questions I have.
You know, one of the aspects that's explored in this film as well is intergenerational trauma, is the pain and the violence suffered by people of your parents' generation,
yeah,
and how that's transmitted to their children, whether they're in the United States or not. Here's Lynn Novick, Ken Burns' co-producer on the Vietnam War, talking about that.
Hearing people talk to us as we've been on the road talking about the film, about how, you know, their parents went through something horrendous and unspeakably terrible and lost. People had to burn their photographs, had to leave everything behind, barely got out with their lives. It's trauma upon trauma upon trauma. And yet, to protect their children and wanting to move on and embrace what America has to offer, the Vietnamese Americans have done incredibly well here because of that energy and resilience and forward-looking attitude.
When you talk about intergenerational trauma, for me personally, I think I realized that the war was not over back in 2009 because I was subpoenaed to come back to Olympia, Washington and testify in a case involving my dad. He and the Vietnamese community of Thurston County had filed a defamation lawsuit against another group of Vietnamese American refugees who were convinced that he was a Viet Cong agent, a communist who was living among us in Washington State. It sounds completely ridiculous, but when I was in that courtroom and listening to all of these stories, it was the first time I heard my dad's play-by-play account of who he was before the war ended, who he became after the war ended, the loss of identity, the loss of opportunity. And he described the escape by boat, and, you know, sitting there in court bawling and kind of just realizing that, boy, you know, the war is just not over. The physical fighting is over, but it stays in your mind. And unless you actually reconcile and deal with it, I think what I saw through that court case was that, you know, you have Vietnamese Americans, and particularly of the older generation, who have not really had a forum to talk about their trauma. And so my theory, and this is just what I think has happened, is you re-victimize. You feel victimized. You feel a sense of loss, and you have to blame somebody. And my concern is that in some quarters of the Vietnamese American community, we start to blame each other.
So do you feel that you and other second generation children of this generation, the war generation from Vietnam, have a role in reconciliation and preventing this re-victimization, as you call it?
Yeah, I think like reconciliation means a lot of different things. I don't think that it's our role to make sure that reconciliation in Vietnam itself, you know, happens. But I do think that we have this privilege of being educated here in the United States, of speaking English, of being able to, you know, look at history, examine history. And I think that we also have that ability to relate to our parents and to find ways to make them feel safe so that they can talk about their stories and own their stories and also support one another. And if we don't acknowledge and recognize our history and the past, history is going to repeat itself. And there's a lot that we still need to learn from the Vietnamese American experience.
Have your folks seen the Ken Burns, Lynn Novick film?
My parents have not. And it's interesting because I think my mother is, she represents a lot of those who are like, why would I want to relive something that I had to feel on a daily basis? But my dad is very curious about it. So he's been like, how do I see this? And fortunately, the film is going to have Vietnamese subtitles, which I think would be really helpful for a lot of older Vietnamese people to be able to watch this film and reflect. And it's going to be a difficult, visceral experience for them, though, because, you know, my father, for instance, fought on the South Vietnamese side. And so for him to see the North Vietnamese perspectives that are featured in the film, some of the Viet Cong perspectives that are featured, I think it's really going to test his will, because he, like many other Vietnamese refugees, have spent many years, I think, feeling pretty angry and sad about the loss of their country.
Tan Tan is host of the second wave podcast, American Stories That Begin in Vietnam. She's been watching the new 18-hour Ken Burns Lynn Novick film, The Vietnam War, and probably her dad's going to watch it too. Tan Tan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's bring the story to here in New York now, where the city paused at the beginning of the week to honor the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. For the last 16 years, part of that commemoration has been the tribute of light, twin beams of light emulating the shape of the Twin Towers, shooting, it seems like forever, up into the night sky. It's a time for reflection, to be sure, but also a time for bird researchers. So this week, Takeaway producer Oliver Lazarus went down to the site where a handful of birders stayed up all night to study the hundreds of thousands of birds drawn to the installation by the tribute.
It's just before 8 p.m. Jessie Adair is lying on her back on the rooftop of a garage in southern Manhattan, and she's looking up.
I'm not a religious person, and I'm not spiritual, but these lights, they're supposedly shooting 4 miles up into the stratosphere. They're breaking through the clouds now, and it looks like they're meeting in a point that's the moon, but it's really like a hole in the clouds they're breaking through. So the lights are breaking through to heaven.
About 100 feet away are two squares of 44 searchlights, each a 7,000-watt xenon bulb pointing straight up that can be seen from over 60 miles away.
In these beams, they look like gossamer curtains. They're not just light beams. They're like they're almost made of fabric.
As the last of the daylight goes, their beams and what's in them becomes increasingly clear.
You can see little things moving, and I heard that they're moths and they're ladybugs, and there's one of the ladies who did these lights said that last week they saw a praying mantis sitting on the lens. These lights are living. They're actually living. They're moving. They're shimmering.
Radar is already showing biological activity in the atmosphere, which we're seeing here too in the form of insects, but the birds will probably start sometime in the next 15 or 20 minutes.
That's Andrew Farnsworth. He works for the Cornell Ornithology Lab.
And I study bird migration. In particular, I'm interested in nocturnal bird migration.
As Americans paused on Monday to commemorate the 16th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, bird researchers and watchers like Farnsworth stayed up all night.
The tribute in light is, from a scientific perspective and a birding perspective, a super rare and unique opportunity.
That's because most bird migration happens at night, when most people are asleep, but the lights are still on.
Nowhere can you see it in the scale where you have these incredibly powerful lights taking a snapshot of what's happening over Manhattan.
And it's the right time of year. September and October are when most birds in the continental U.S. are migrating south. The tribute in light functions like two giant test tubes, ideal for studying how the light emitted from cities across the country affects the behavior of the millions of birds making their way south. And since birds are considered an indicator species, found in every habitat and environment, Andrew's research is on the cutting edge of how our love of light is affecting non-human animals.
The intensity and the extent of light pollution has, you can use any superlative you like to describe it. It all of them apply. And again, it's all part of understanding, well, what does that mean in terms of ecosystem services that are getting dramatically impacted by some aspect of human behavior?
Andrew Farnsworth is camping out with about 20 other researchers tonight.
I have good old binoculars, typical birder tool, of course. I have these two closed-circuit television cameras to identify the altitude, direction, and speed of birds.
The images look like they're straight out of Hitchcock. There are lots of cameras clicking constantly. There are NASA radars, and teams set up on multiple buildings around the site using walkie-talkies to communicate.
There's a downy woodpecker that just landed on the side of the building north of the north beam. Now it's flying left.
I got it. Yeah, I got it. That's crazy.
Also, insect researchers.
There have been a species of cicada, a giant diving water beetle, owlet moths, some perowid moths, and noctuid moths.
I brushed the dead bugs off the lights.
There are even teams of volunteers with the New York Audubon Society, looking up at the lights and counting how many birds and what types of birds they see.
So we're recording the number that we're estimating every 20 minutes, as well as the atmospheric conditions, whether it's cloudy or rainy or things of that nature.
This is the third year I've done it, and it just seems huge. The numbers, they're just, and at various heights. And
when they see large flocks of birds, generally 1,000 at a time, that's their cue to get the lights shut down for about 30 minutes.
The big concern is collisions. And of course, I mean, this is a place where nobody wants to see any more death at all.
And you can actually hear that disorientation through the mics that Farnsworth has set up.
In periods when birds are concentrating at the lights in particular, the flight calling goes through the roof. And it's very likely, because it's associated with birds being disoriented, they're calling to one another, probably to try to get information about where other individuals are, which way is away from the lights, etc., etc.
By the time it's midnight, about a dozen birders are pretty much the only people left in the area closed off to the public. But the birds keep on coming.
Tonight, I'd probably say it would be in the 100 to 200,000 bird range, maybe. If you look from the radar perspective, maybe not from actual our visual perspective, it might be closer to, you know, that we're seeing 10 to 15,000.
I think the number's 900 or more now.
By daybreak on September 12th, the lights will have been shut off 3 times, and Farnsworth and his Cornell team will have thousands of pieces of data to sort through, some of it going to Cornell's Macaulay Library, which has the largest collection of wildlife sound in the world, but all of it being used to figure out how birds and other species can survive in an environment that is increasingly dominated by humans. Though on the roof, there's just something fun and new about being there for Farnsworth.
As a child, I was fascinated by movements of birds. There's something different about being able to actually see it and to have a whole other sensory modality to experience what is happening and what birds are doing, and do so in a place that is completely, perhaps, the polar opposite of what you would expect. And yet, when I look up above me, there are, you know, hundreds of birds circling around in the lights. There are red starts, there are ovenbirds, and I can see them, I can hear them, and I can understand what they're doing.
At midnight on the rooftop garage, a handful of people are still taking pictures. It's the 16th year of the Tribute in Lights. And for New Yorkers like Jesse Adair, the immediate aftermath of the original showing 6 months after 9/11 is still fresh in her memory. But the little specks and moving dots in the light mean something different now.
A lot of what was moving was ash. That ash not only represented airplanes and buildings and dirt, it represented people. But now, the living things have taken over. The moths and the ladybugs and the praying mantises and everything else that's up there being drawn to the light. They're not stagnant, they're alive. And if that doesn't say something to the world, I don't know what does.
For The Takeaway, I'm Oliver Lazarus.
It's a great report there from our producer, Oliver Lazarus. And, you know, we started the show today with what a lot of people might see as a radical idea. I don't know about you. I know I'm not on board with this. Getting rid of the U.S. Constitution. All right, but how do we improve it instead? If you could add a 28th Amendment to the Constitution, what would it be?
I'm calling from Evanston, Illinois. I would add an amendment that presidential elections must hereby be decided by popular vote, because we have had presidents who do not reflect the popular opinion. And there should be an automatic impeachment trial when the national polling, the approval rating is 25% for the president. In that case, he or she is not representing the country, and 4 years is way too long to wait for a new election.
Get rid of the Electoral College and more power to the mob. That's one idea for the 28th Amendment. We want to hear yours, too. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.